Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, May 5th, 2015. And this says, before the first cup of jewels here on UCY.TV, happy Cinco de Mayo. I think that's what today is. It is 61 degrees and overcast here in upstate New York. It's actually pretty nice. Looks like it's going to rain any minute, but I'm just looking at the map, and everything's down in Pennsylvania, so I guess that's okay. We had a little bit of rain. It got up to 80 here yesterday, so I guess winter is finally completely gone. It's kind of a happy thought. So listen, guys, yesterday, if you got to hear the show, we talked about a lot of interesting connections between some of these quote-unquote outbreaks that have been going on or apparently going on across the board. We looked at, if I can even remember, it's so hard for me to remember, 24 hours ago even. We looked at some of the dog flu, and then we looked at bird flu, and we looked at, I don't remember what else. Calling out, this is actually something I wanted to bring your attention to if you didn't get to hear the show yesterday. By the way, it is the one and only archive ever that apparently we lost. It is, as SLC Mike called it yesterday, the Before the First Cup Lost episode. So I want to ask if there was anybody out there that happened to record it. I'm sure there's probably millions of people that record the show every day. Or, hey, Mr. NSA, if you're out there, if there's anyone who recorded the show, drop me a message at contact@ucytv@gmail.com. We had a little glitch because Friday, we had changed all of the master programming to facilitate the Vax Truth Marathon that we had going on here for 16 hours simulcasting, and we were actually doing an archive for them. And unfortunately, the one show that was a Monday through Friday show that all 5 days got turned off as part of setting them up to record just on Friday was Before the First Cup. And there was lots of stuff going on here this weekend, and we completely forgot to turn the recording back on. And I mean, we even have two forms of recording. One does per show, and one does like a massive record. So in case something ever happens to the individual show record, we have this master record that we can go in and chop up if we had to get an individual show out. And that was turned off too because we just don't have the storage to record 16 straight hours for a show that especially isn't one of our shows. So we were just doing the hourly for them. But yeah, so the primary and the backup archiving methods were both turned off for the show yesterday. So I was pretty depressed about it because I thought it made some good connections. But anyway, so as a recap, because I'm not going to do the show over again. I even considered that, like doing another hour off air, just recording it and pushing it up with the same topics. But then I was like, nah, can't have the passion that you had the first time around. And, you know, I figured if you caught it, that'll encourage you to be here on time. Though, like I said, it's the first time ever in 2¾ years now that we've lost an archive. So I don't feel too bad. And I actually am glad it was mine versus one of the other hosts, because then I would have felt really horribly bad if I lost somebody else's show. So anyway, if you missed it yesterday, I really apologize because there is not a copy of it. But like I said, if anybody out there happened to record the show, any of the millions and millions of people who record the show every day, please drop me an email because I would greatly appreciate getting a copy of that, at least to throw up on YouTube. But one of the things that we had talked about was this out of the blue bird flu pandemic that apparently has been going on, percolating quietly, that they didn't happen to mention in any large scale until just recently. And now it is so far out of control, apparently, that in Minnesota, they called in the National Guard to euthanize turkeys. The National Guard sergeant had even said, what? Like, they were really surprised that they were being called in to euthanize turkeys. And the most horrifying part of it was that the story talks about the reason why they were calling in the National Guard is because the National Guard has tons of water that they can carry. And they needed, it was more water than any of the farms had on site and they needed this water to be able to, how did they put it? To create this foam that then I guess they suffocate the turkeys with. I mean, such an amazingly horrifying thought. I'm just looking here. There was a story. Oh, here, let's do this if it loads. Hold on. I might even be connected. It's trying to load. I didn't know that there was a link and a video that went along with it. Says it's buffering. Buffering, buffering. Yeah, here. We'll check this out. Just because I didn't get this on record yesterday and I want people to know about this. This is probably one of the screwiest things I've seen in a long time. And the reason why it caught my attention was because in the very beginning, when we had the quote unquote Ebola outbreak, remember when Obama authorized troops to go fight Ebola in Africa? We were like, what? Why are we sending troops to go fight a virus? Well, apparently it's becoming the new normal as we're sending National Guard troops to go fight sick turkeys. All right, here, let me see if I can get this video to play. Play. Maybe we'll have to sing. Da, 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 da. It was just loading just a second ago. And now the page is spinning and I'm getting twitchy eye. It's too early to get a twitchy eye. Come on. This is not the way to start out a show. We're going to have to give up on the turkeys in just a second. Well, this sucks because now it is a black screen. Let me try to reload it one more time. At least it's warm here, but it's very warm in here. I had to put the air conditioner in the window already. And it is kind of early for being just the beginning of May to have to be firing up the air conditioner. Well, fiddlesticks, because now the page isn't even reloading. Holy crap, here it comes. I really think this computer is a big part of my twitchy eye. I gotta tell you, this computer needs a baseball bat. Dee, 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 dee. Well, I'm gonna give up on this in a second, and you're gonna have to just believe me. Because I don't have the patience nor the attitude to wait for this. Here, maybe this one will play. It's buffering. I can at least read this little story. The National Guard deployed 15 trucks and 30 soldiers to Candiyohi County on Monday, which has been ground zero for Minnesota's avian flu outbreak. It is an unusual deployment for the National Guard, which usually responds to flood areas or wildfires. We did read this yesterday, like I said, for the record. Quote, "It seems strange. The bird flu outbreak. I didn't think the National Guard would be activated," said Staff Sergeant Alyssa Graham. "But once we learned our mission yesterday, it all makes sense now. Each truck can carry 2,000 gallons of water, which will be used to euthanize turkeys at the infected farm. The foam will be used to kill large amounts of turkey, requires more water than many farms are equipped to provide. It is a peacetime mission for the National Guard." A peacetime mission. See, this is a different article that was linked to, and they didn't say that in the other one. It is a peacetime mission for the National Guard, but for the people of Candiyohi County, the avian flu outbreak is every bit an emergency. There is no way we have enough equipment in a rural area like this to keep it up, said Matt Erickson, a part-time firefighter. Erickson has watched as the avian flu has spread from farm to farm, decimating his neighbors' flocks. That is their main livelihood, and it is hard. It is hard on the whole town. 3 million turkeys in Minnesota have been killed so far, and four new infected farms were announced on Monday. The National Guard deployment is expected to last until at least Wednesday, at which point the USDA hopes to have a private contractor in Candiyohi County with even bigger water trucks. Oh my God. So they're going to kill them even faster with private contractors, probably somehow related to Blackwater, I would imagine. The death squads. They're going to call up the contracted death squads and let them loose in Minnesota. It's just very disturbing to me. And the fact that they're suffocating these animals.
It's a peacetime mission, but for the people of Candiota County, the avian flu crisis is every bit an emergency.
He's going to read the
National Guard trucks, a welcome sight.
You know, there's no way we got enough equipment around, you know, in a rural area like this to keep up.
Matt Erickson is a part-time firefighter in the small town.
And there the video ends. All right. All right. Oh, well, I guess I'm going to kill this.
This fucking sucks.
Bink. That's the end of the story. It drives me crazy when stuff doesn't work. All right. So where do we go from here? Now that completely broke my flow. So we've been talking outbreaks the last couple days. Like I said, that lost episode yesterday connected a bunch of dots that we're not connecting today. So if you got to hear it, you got to connect the points. And if you didn't, well, then you'll just have to take my word for it. But a couple other things I wanted to point out. One of the things that I saw, you know, we talked about Ebola. We followed Ebola closely when it was happening here. And there were some questions as to whether or not Ebola lasts in the body and how long the incubation period was. I remember it was originally 28 days. Then they had questioned that because some people had potentially shown longer incubation times. Then there was question two, how long the Ebola virus actually stayed in the body after you were cured. And there had been some proof that Ebola had remained active in semen. And so as they were letting people out of quarantine who had potentially had Ebola and then had been quote unquote cured, you know, their questions had still been out there as to whether or not it could be spread from person to person through other bodily fluids. Well, after they announced the other day that they thought they had an Ebola patient in Tarrant County, which they came out and said, no, now it isn't, but they're not quite sure what this person has. Another story came out, and this is in a local television or radio publication, KCENTV.com. It says, Liberian woman appears to have contracted Ebola through sex with survivor. And this was one of the concerns that they originally had during the outbreak at the end of last year. This is a story that actually came out of USA Today, I guess. They republished it. A Liberian woman appears to have contracted Ebola from unprotected sex with a man who survived the virus, health officials said today. The 44-year-old woman was diagnosed March 20th. Wow, that's nice. This was a story from May 1st, and we're just finding out about it now. Was diagnosed March 20th, the first new Ebola case in Liberia in a month. Doctors were perplexed by her case because she hadn't been to a funeral or had any other contact with current patients, according to the report for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. But the woman did have unprotected intercourse a few weeks earlier with a 45-year-old Ebola survivor who has been free of the disease for months. Ding, ding, ding. The man developed the disease in September and was discharged from a treatment center in early October. That man has also had sex with a second woman who is not tested positive for CDC, said the CDC. Although doctors have known for some time that the Ebola virus can survive in semen long after the patient is considered cured, there has never been a clear documented case for this happening, according to the report. People who survive Ebola and whose blood tests show no signs of the virus are generally considered to be non-infectious. The virus is spread through contact with bodily fluids and typically spreads through blood, a fact that has put health workers at very high risk of Ebola. People cannot spread the virus through casual contact, such as working in the same office or riding the bus, and it, according to them, does not spread through air. But the studies conducted during previous outbreaks have found that Ebola virus can be found in semen up to 82 days after a patient's initial symptoms. Scientists do not know if that man's semen contained live Ebola virus, although they plan to conduct such tests. So, I mean, after we just had how many thousands of people who contracted this disease, many of whom died, a bunch of whom actually did survive the disease with treatment, And there were a bunch of doctors in this country that they sent back here for treatment. And now we're finding out for at least 82 days it can be passed on in semen. Is anybody tracking these people? Because it doesn't sound like they are. They said, oh, that this is something that they're going to plan to conduct tests. So makes you wonder if there isn't now some sort of percolating future Ebola, quote unquote, epidemic coming in a second wave. I mean, 82 days. What is that? That's just under 3 months, October. So we should have started seeing it in March, which is about when, you know, October to December. That's about when the cases here stopped popping up when they were sending them here. But I just think that's kind of interesting. That was something that they had questioned before, but now this apparently is like a proven case. It says the test of the man's semen did find genetic material from the Ebola virus called, ding, 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 RNA. And we're going to talk about some RNA stuff today. The tests were performed 199 days. Or about 6.5 months after he first developed symptoms, suggesting that genetic material can remain in semen much longer than previously known. Earlier studies have found genetic material from Ebola up to 101 days after the beginning of symptoms, said the CDC. Well, shouldn't they have been quarantining people if they knew that it could be up to 101 days? I would say 101 days should have been the quarantine. And the CDC notes one of the previous cases of a possible sexual transmission of Ebola, although a new report describes the evidence as inconclusive. Researchers also documented a possible case in which someone contracted the Marburg virus, which is similar to Ebola, in 1968 through semen. The CDC has long warned Ebola survivors to either abstain from sex for 3 months or to use condoms during that time. Like, how many people are going to run out and have sex with an Ebola survivor? That's pretty sick. The CDC advises people to avoid contact with male survivor semen. Men who survive Ebola should use condoms if they have sex and take care when disposing of them. Yes, toxic waste. According to the World Health Organization, 26,298 people have been infected with Ebola in the West African outbreak. 10,882 have died, mostly in Liberia, Guinea, and Sierra Leone. Liberia's had no new cases in 5 weeks. And that country's last confirmed case died on March 27th. I'm sorry. The World Health Organization declares countries to be Ebola-free 42 days after the last known case. And that was the number we were doing 21 days, I believe, for the watch period. But 42, I thought, was the official international quarantine number. If there are no additional cases, Liberia could be declared Ebola free on May 9th. And there was another story, I believe they have just closed down. They had just closed down the treatment facilities in Africa that our Obama military went over there to help build. Let me see if, let me see. I'm scrolling right now to see if I can find that Liberia story, because there was a video on that. And I was surprised because there's been like zero Ebola news in a very long time. So, oh, yeah. U.S. decommissions its Ebola treatment unit in Liberia. So hold on. This is from a few days ago. Let's hear what they have to say about this. So they must have sent our troops home, I guess. It doesn't. U.S. closes Ebola treatment unit for Liberian health workers.
Because we felt we did not know how to respond. We did not have the capacity or the resources to respond. We reached out. And I want to say that the United States responded in a very significant way.
Wow, one of the things that's pretty sick is they're having this event here right as they're decommissioning. There's an American flag. It looks like probably made by African children, and it's using hand paint. But it's like for the stripes on the flag, they have little kids' handprints going across from heel to toe, you know, from palm to fingers across, making the stripes, but they're done in red paint, so they almost look bloody. It's kind of sick. All right, wait, here.
Well, we had 42 patients come in with symptoms. Only 18 were Ebola positive, and we had 9 survivors. Now, the folks that unfortunately succumbed to the disease, some of them really, when they got here, they were already very far along in their disease, so it was very hard for us. So, but every patient received the same high level of care.
And that's about it. There really wasn't much information, but it makes you wonder. So we built all those facilities. We sent all those soldiers over there. We didn't hear much after that. I know that they were going to be rotating them in and out when they were off duty into Italy, and they were going to put them into quarantine, but then you didn't hear anything else. From one of the things that we did hear is that many of those units were never used then after we constructed them all. But I did just see a story that we touched on the other day that the Department of Defense went to the World Health Organization, and I believe that there were 5 virulent material facilities in Africa that they were now getting the samples from and potentially going in. And it wasn't really clear to me if we were going to be taking over the World Health Organization facilities in the African nations, or if we were just going to be getting their samples to add to the global database of virulent material. But it'll be interesting to see. And remember, Africa is now threatened with a measles outbreak. So, okay, I want to get over all this because this is stuff that we have talked about on and off over the last few months. One of the other things that I want to touch on is a story that I talked about a few years ago. I've talked about it actually many times since the story first came out. This was one out of National Geographic, but we're starting to see in multiple cases now. In Ebola, we had multiple dogs that were euthanized, right, because they were potential disease vectors. The owners who had been infected with Ebola, and they said, well, the dogs can get it. They could carry it. They could spread it. So they had to euthanize the dogs. Then we saw now this doggy flu that apparently is spreading across the Midwest. And a few stories said that it was some sort of bird flu strain, and a few stories said, well, it wasn't, but it's the H3N2 and the H5N8 or something, which sure as hell looks like bird flu strains to me, but whatever. And that you need to potentially get your pet vaccinated, though this year's flu vaccine doesn't work, but it may help them get your doggy that causes you to have an oxytocin reaction, so you love them like a child, bring them in and become a proponent for vaccines because it'll keep your doggy safe. Then we saw the bubonic plague. That was another one we talked about yesterday. They announced a year later that a pit bull in Colorado apparently was patient zero for infecting 4 individuals with pneumonic plague. And though it normally doesn't manifest in a serious disease in dogs, in this case it didn't. It was the first time potentially that they had seen that it had jumped from a dog to a person, or potentially passed from person to person, which they weren't really sure if it had all gone from dog to person or person to person. But be aware that the symptoms of the doggy flu, which potentially could have been a bird flu, and the pneumonic plague in that Colorado dog seemed to be pretty similar. We looked at how odd that was. And then, of course, in some of the same states, we have the dog flu, which could potentially be a part of a bird flu that seemed to have jumped species. We also have bird flu raging, like in Minnesota, as a pandemic, and there's been an emergency declared. And, oh, what? They call out the National Guard for euthanization. So one of the stories, I mean, here's the thing. Is all this happening naturally? I mean, a lot of the stories that I have seen, they start blaming all this crap on global warming. Be afraid, be very afraid. Because now with global warming, it's going to lead to needing all of us to be vaccinated. We have now all the parents who felt bad for Johnny's, I always bring it up, Johnny's vacation being ruined at Disneyland, going after the anti-vaxxers because measles was such a horrible disease. You know, now we have all of the pet lovers going after anti-vaxxers because, you know, anti-vaxxers are going to get Fido sick. We also have, actually, I wanted to hit this one, a story that came out on May 1st. Actually, April posted this one out of sciencealert.com. Painless vaccine patches are set to begin clinical trials in 2017. Oh, you don't have to worry about crying anymore, Johnny, because there's no more big nasty needle. We just put a little sticky patch that maybe we have a Hello Kitty on your arm and you'll be all better. Says, painless vaccine patches are set to begin clinical trials in 2017. If there's one thing the developed world needs better access to, it's vaccinations against diseases like measles, polio, and yellow fever. And oh, how interesting that we just had some mysterious outbreak with mosquitoes in California. I don't know if you remember, we read that story a couple days ago, and it seems that we have yellow fever in California now. It says, because they're traditionally administered by injection, vaccinations require sterile environments and a trained professional to administer, plus constant refrigeration, all of which can get very expensive. Researchers have been working for years on a better alternative to a needle, and we might finally be close to a viable solution, a little patch covered in micro needles that can be applied to the skin to deliver a painless dose of medication. Cheap to produce, easy to store, and requiring no medical professional to administer. Oh, how wonderful would that be? The school nurse could be giving your kid their vaccinations, or oh, how about the gym teacher? These nifty little devices could change everything. Developed by a team at Georgia Tech and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in the U.S., the patches are about a square centimeter in size, and on one side, it is lined with 100 solid conical micro needles made from polymer, sugar, and a vaccine drug. And when we say micro, we mean it. They're only a fraction of a millimeter long, and when the patch is applied to the skin, the micro needles are inserted into the upper layers of the skin before dissolving and releasing the vaccine. Ah, this is making my eye twitch. They are so close to being ready that the researchers expect to start clinical trials with a measles variety in 2017. Well, I bet you it's going to be when the next measles outbreak hits Africa. As Alexandra Olsona notes in Popular Science, while we've been hearing about vaccine patches for almost a decade now, this is about as close as we've seen the technology actually get to being a viable product. This is because of the challenges scientists have faced when trying to get a vaccination to permeate through the skin and into the bloodstream, and getting it to be as effective as just injecting it there has been difficult. Georgia Tech researchers are not the only ones working on a vaccine patch, but they have long been at the forefront of this field. The team recently completed another study in monkeys and found that their measles patch vaccine worked just as well as a vaccine administered by needles and had no adverse side effects. Yeah, except for the vaccine side effects. According to the study published in the journal Vaccine in March, their patch takes about 10 minutes to work on their monkey subjects and effectively generated neutralizing antibody responses to the measles virus. They were stored at a range of temperatures that would be realistic in various parts of the world, reportedly held up fine. Each day, 400 children are killed by measles complications worldwide. Like I said, measles was never a bad virus. It was ancillary infections, mainly encephalitis and things of that nature. With no needles, syringes, sterile water, or sharp disposal needed, the micropatch needle offers great hope of a new tool to reach the world's children faster. Of course, it's always for the children, even in the most remote areas. This advancement would be a major boost in our efforts to eliminate this disease with more vaccines administered and more lives saved at less cost. Yes, it is going to be cheaper to poke you. Now, it's interesting because I was digging through a new 2015 breakthrough technologies for national security DARPA PDF the other day. And one of the things that is on the forefront of their 2015 spend is all these newfangled vaccines. We've looked tons at DARPA and the crazy technologies that they're employing, dealing with nanotechnology and manipulating DNA with RNAi and nanoparticles. And I got to see if I can find that story really quick here. I don't know. There's been so much stuff in that vaccine marathon on Friday actually put me off a day. So now I'm like way back. I don't know if I'll be able to find it or not. I hate when this happens because there's just too much for me to handle. Yeah, it's not... I'm not finding it. We're going to have to check this out. Hold on. We might be able to find it. Plus, anyway, who doesn't want to hear me sing, right? I'm looking for it. Oh, damn it. Oh, well, you know what? We're making this the Monday show. There was a good story in here, and it was about, I had it open upstairs. It was actually about, oh, here it is. You know, all the stuff that we were looking at in regards to RNA and RNAi, RNA interference, being able to flip switches on and off with RNA in your DNA strand. And I mean, they were doing this not just with vaccines, but Monsanto was also using the same technology for their 2015. We looked at their 2015 beginning year report of all the things that they had on the plate for research and development, the products they were going to be producing. And they were using RNAi as a way to create insect-resistant foods. We listened to some video clips from Dr. Huber when he was talking about glyphosate and some of the long-term effects glyphosate can potentially have on the organisms that come in contact with it, how it will cause you to not properly uptake nutrients and potentially chelate out essential minerals. And I mean, as these things go into our body, you know, people don't seem to realize that the statement "you are what you eat" is way more true than what we ever believed. And as we start creating this mad science gone mad science and then eating it with no real studies to see what's going to happen in the long term, we have a real big problem. So I ran across, and we'll get back to the zombie virus story from 2010. Yeah, October 2010. I couldn't believe I actually found that story. But I want to hit this one story that came out about these brand new GMO apples and potatoes that the FDA just released and approved. We've talked about the revolving door between the regulatory agencies and some of these biotech companies such as Monsanto, Michael Taylor being one, and how in the very beginning, and I remember this whole GMO argument when it first started in the 90s, and I was very against it then, though I really didn't know a lot about it because there wasn't a lot of information about it. But scientists even back then were saying, hey, we don't know how this is going to affect future generations. And guys, this is the same thing that's happening with the vaccines. A lot of the same technologies are being utilized where they're messing with genetic code and then launching it, opening up the bottle and letting the genie out and launching it into the petri dish that we call Earth to then just cross our fingers and hope everything turns out okay. Remember, line item R&D budget, they don't have to shell out their money anymore if there's real live experiments going on that they can watch. It doesn't cost anything when you and I are the collateral damage. and there's no way to, like, dotted line track it back to hold anybody liable, or laws that really give you any leg to stand on for suing anybody. So anyway, there's a video here, and they talk about some really good points and some dangers that they've already found with this new apple and this new potato. And they also point out the fact, something that we've talked about quite a number of times, is how this FDA is just rubber stamping any of these new fangled technologies, because they say, as far as chemically speaking, an apple is an apple. So if there's a few tweaks to an RNA strand, so now it has a double flagella versus a single flagella, well, that's still just an RNA strand. How is that any different? Well, this story really looks at, there is a big difference. Some RNA strands are innocuous and some are not. And some of the experiments that independent researchers have done has shown a marked change in the organism's genetic material after just one feeding of these mutated foods. Just one feeding. Anyway, so let's check this out. This is by a group that I ran across not too long ago, and I subscribed to their page, and they've been putting out some great stuff. You might want to check them out. It's called the Institute for Responsible Technology. At least there's a group out there like us that's looking at the stuff going, whoa, back the truck up, Chuck. Their site URL is responsibletechnology.org. Highly recommended. You should check them out. This is titled, Why Scientists Are Worried About the GMO Potato and Apple. Says, the question that serious scientists are asking is, if we, or bees, or deer, or birds, consume this double-stranded RNA in the apple or potato, can it work to influence how our genes work? Will these genetically modified organisms, eaten as an apple pie, French fries, or whatever, change our development, physiology, and behavior? When Brazilian researchers fed tiny pieces of RNA to young honeybees, they expected little to happen, certainly nothing earth-shaking. The RNA used is not naturally found in bees. It was taken from jellyfish, chosen because it was supposed to have an insignificant impact. The RNA did not cooperate. After mixing a single meal of RNA into the natural diet of a worker bee larva, as the bees grew older, scientists discovered that a staggering 1,461 genes showed significant changes compared to the control group. In other words, about 10% of all the bees' genes, including those genes that were vital to the bee's health, were either turned up in volume or, more often than not, turned down. And that's talking about that whole RNA interference. That's what the interference does. It turns off genes. And they use double-stranded RNA to do that. The author of the study concluded that such a massive change undoubtedly triggered changes in the bee's development, physiology, and behavior. Now, after everything that we've looked at already, and we're going to do a couple more stories on this, I think tomorrow this is where we're going to start. When we've looked at this microbiome, you know, as they've been digging into the genome, they've started realizing that there's this whole other ecosystem that exists in our body called the microbiome. It really kind of starts in your gut bacteria. The vagus nerve, we discovered in our research, connects our gut directly to our brain. And that gut bacteria has a massive impact on our health, our nutrition, and how our body works. So there's this massive study now ongoing, trying to understand the microbiome, the symbiotic relationship our body has with living special bacteria in our body that helps keep us healthy beyond just vitamins, minerals, and nutrition. And how, when they mess with that microbiome, how it can either make you sick or healthy. Now, a few of you in chat were there yesterday when I mentioned I ran across an ad in Scientific American magazine about a webinar that is occurring tomorrow, right after the show, as a matter of fact. It's being sponsored by Nestle Research, I think. And that's actually one of the other things I want to mention in this story that we're reading about the apple and the potato. They talk about something that we've also talked about, how there is no research department like a nationwide GMO research department that's creating GMOs or researching GMOs. It is up to the individual corporation to have their own scientists to create their own GMOs. And then the FDA is pretty much rubber stamping them. And they are rubber stamping them because, hey, an apple is an apple is an apple. A potato is a potato is a potato. But what ethical scientists are discovering is that is not necessarily the case. It can cause a cascade reaction in your body that then messes with the microbiome, that then is passed down genetically to offspring in ways that we can't even imagine yet. So anyway, I don't have the information for this webinar, but I am going to recommend anyone that's out there who wants to keep up and then do a little bit of homework after the show tomorrow with me. There were a few of us in chat that all signed up for this Nestle webinar, and they're going to have three scientists, Nestle scientists, on talking about what they've been learning in the lab about the microbiome and how to use food to be able to manipulate the microbiome for health in humans. So not only are we going to have to worry about vaccine patches that the gym teacher can slap on your kid, but we're going to have to worry about them feeding us quote unquote health fixes in our food without us even knowing it, because none of this is even required to be labeled. Anyway, okay, so let's get back to this apple and potato story, because this really had to be the most disturbing story that I read of the day yesterday. So by just one feeding of this genetically modified food that they fed these worker bee larvae, it caused 1,461 genes to change, something that they hadn't expected at all, especially after they had said that this jellyfish RNA that they were using was believed to not have any effect whatsoever. So they were like, whoops. Anyway, okay, perhaps the scientists from the USDA missed the 2013 study when they recently approved potatoes and apples genetically engineered not to brown. The Arctic apple slices named Botox apple, like, yeah, that's something I want to eat, can supposedly sit on a shelf for 15 to 18 days cut without discoloring to reveal their age. Sliced up innate potatoes will similarly not show any darkening day after day until they eventually dry up. And remember when we first read about this Botox apple, they were spinning it as such a good thing because you can give it to little Johnny in his lunchbox and little Johnny's not going to complain when it comes to lunchtime and it's brown. So let's load this into our kids. I mean, I really, they are using our children as real life guinea pigs, and people are just lining up. I mean, it's like the sacrificial lamb. Why would you make your kid generation one? Any parent who would do that has a fucking screw loose. That's all I can say. Any parent who doesn't take the time and effort to look at the chemicals that they're putting into the shampoos and the soaps and anything else. I mean, when my kid was a baby, I started to flip out when I started digging into the ingredients into simple baby lotions from Johnson & Johnson or the shampoos, the biphenyl A, the hormone disruptors. I was like, are you kidding me? Johnson & Johnson baby formulas with all of these horrible ingredients. I mean, why? And why would they allow them to do that? I mean, it's, you know, and we see the results now. We see all these I don't even get me started on such politically incorrect criticism of us losing the ability to be a sex. I mean, you know, now we're like this unisex that they're turning our kids into by fucking with all the hormones. And this is just one big crazy experiment. You know, once everything's unisex, you won't want to reproduce anymore. And then, you know, you'll be all right with the machine. You won't have any fight left in you. I don't know. There's such a huge connecting group of dots here. It's just highly disturbing, but I can't get off the topic because we only got about 10 minutes left and I want to finish this apple and potato story. My eye literally will not stop twitching now. This probably wasn't a good thing. All right. Anyway, so we have apples that can sit around for 15 to 18 days without Johnny ever having to whine about his brown apple slices, and potatoes that can be cut up and be good until they literally dry up sitting on a shelf without refrigeration. I mean, how disgusting is that? Would you eat that food? I know I wouldn't, just on the principle. All right, so let's continue on. It says, perhaps the scientists from the USDA missed the 2013 study, so we already read that. To accomplish this effect, scientists at the Okanagan Specialty Fruits and J.R. Simplot introduced genetically engineered genes that made their apples and potatoes produce double-stranded RNA, which is abbreviated dsRNA, to shut off the browning genes, which is using double-stranded RNA in this RNA interference technique that they use. Double-stranded RNA is the same type of RNA that was fed to the bees. The question that serious scientists are asking is, will these genetically modified organisms change our development, our physiology, and our behavior? Well, one of those serious scientists is Jack Heineman, a professor of genetics and molecular biology and the director of the Center of Integrated Research and Biosafety at the University of Canterbury in New Zealand. Yay, New Zealand! For more than a decade, he has been warning agencies that approve GMO about the need to test new double-stranded RNA for safety. RNA is the way station molecule between genes, which are made of DNA, and the proteins that they specify. Years ago, scientists were sure that the influence only went in one direction. DNA would pass on a code to RNA, which would then design proteins on that basis. Now it is understood that types of RNA, such as double-stranded RNA, exert a significant influence in the opposite direction. Whoops. Genetic engineering can introduce new double-stranded RNA into our food. And this can be done intentionally, as in the case of the apple and the potato, or totally by accident. In either case, these may be, quote, new patterns that we've never seen before, says Heineman. We can be exposed to these and have and potentially have genes regulated by those double-stranded RNA molecules. And this is what I had to love in this story. They actually had a whole section set that's called Government Safety Assurances Are a Sham. And they are absolutely right. They are. RNA, according to regulators, is too unstable. It would be destroyed long before it could enter the blood supply. And even if it were to get into the blood supply, regulators claim it wouldn't have any effect whatsoever. While it is true that most RNA are not stable, Heineman points out that, surprisingly, the form of RNA called double-stranded RNA is very, very stable. And it has now been shown that they can be taken up after digestion of the food into our blood supply. More importantly, in a groundbreaking study conducted in China in 2012, double-stranded RNA fed to mice, quote, transferred to the liver and down-regulated an important liver enzyme. Now, liver enzymes help you in digestion. And in these mice, they ate this food that then the double-stranded DNA that was in their food used RNA interference to flip switches off in enzyme production in the liver. That's got to be really disturbing. This study provided early evidence that the excuses used by regulators were just that and not backed by any science. So when Heinemann read the government's evaluation of a GMO wheat variety that uses double-stranded RNA to alter its starch productions, he was alarmed to find that all the new published research about double-stranded RNA was totally ignored. We're not surprised now, are we? Quote, when we looked at the regulators' risk assessment, we found that they never considered the potential adverse effect of the intended double-stranded RNA either on people, and this was an approval to test it on people, or on the unintended targets in the environment. They simply assumed that RNA cannot be toxic. In addition to regurgitating some of the same outdated arguments of double-stranded DNA instability and lack of influence, they added three more. According to Heinemann, the regulators claimed that double-stranded RNA, quote, would never accumulate to levels that would have a biological effect, unquote. But he points out that there are zero experiments testing how much dietary double-stranded RNA is necessary for a biological effect. It was a baseless argument. And like I've said so many times, that's why I call this mad science gone mad. They are not testing any of this stuff. We are the Generation One guinea pig. And they're feeding it to our kids. They're marketing it to our kids. And then, hey, let's have nationalized healthcare where everyone's bagged and tagged in a database so then we can use that data as our research and development for free. How wonderful is that? And especially with Obamacare not being legally considered a healthcare plan, it is not covered under any of the anti-kickback laws. So we can have these big pharmaceutical companies that are using your child out of the database as their free research and development, giving your doctor free trips to Cancun in exchange for him giving your kids the new vaccine or recommending the new GMO apples to make them healthy. Or, hey, what? Some of the new Nestle food that'll fix your ills that's coming to a shelf near you. It's very disturbing, people. Continue. Then, when using a rather strained logic, the regulatory agencies flatly claimed, according to Heinemann, quote, because RNA is everywhere, well then, it must be safe. It is our background baseline of safety, unquote. While Heinemann acknowledges that the chemical properties of RNA molecules are generally the same, it is not their chemical composition, the nucleic acids, that are critical. They miss the most important thing about nucleic acids, he says. The activity of nucleic acid is the specific sequence of nucleotides along the backbone of the molecule. And it's that specific sequence that determines if and how the double-stranded RNA influences gene expression. So some double-stranded RNA will be safe, and some will not. The point becomes very obvious when you realize that GMO companies such as Monsanto are hoping to get approval for crops they engineered with double-stranded RNA to kill insects. And that's what I was talking about in the 2015 forward-looking statement of Monsanto. They had all kinds of projects that they were already working on using RNA interference to flip off switches in bugs to, like, uptake nutrients, let's say. Some of the same stuff that they are now seeing in the colony collapse disorder, according to Dr. Huber. Where even though the bees had plenty of food, they were starving to death after being exposed to glyphosate, mind you. This is taking the next generation of insecticides where they're literally manipulating the DNA of organisms. And I think that actually there's probably some of that already going on in the glyphosate from some of the research I've been doing. It has such a huge influence on so many different systems and immune biology in our bodies and killing gut bacteria, guys. I really think that there's a lot more going on in glyphosate than we even know. Anyway, back to this. So it says Monsanto, the same double-stranded RNA to kill insects, quote, every RNA molecule eaten by insects does not kill them, says Heinemann. But certain double-stranded RNA molecules do because of the order of their nucleotides. Feeding studies required in order to evaluate the real risk. You cannot rely on computer models alone. Heinemann insists there must be feeding studies using those organisms that will be exposed to the double-stranded RNA if GMOs are to be released outdoors or commercialized. Political science posing as science, knowing that the USDA and the EPA scientists and advisors warned about unpredictable, unintended effects that could escape detection by current risk assessments, one might think that the approval of the apple and the potato should at least have waited until those assessments were thoroughly updated. But that would require those in charge of the USDA to make decisions based on science. And even a cursory review of the history of US GMO regulations demonstrates just the opposite. In the 1990s, for example, FDA scientists repeatedly warned their superiors about inherent dangers of genetically engineering crops for human consumption. They wrote of possible toxins, allergens, new diseases, and nutritional problems that will be hard to detect in gene-spliced foods. But the person in charge of GMO policy at the agency at that time was Michael Taylor, a political appointee, not a scientist. And in fact, he was the former attorney for Monsanto. The policy he oversaw falsely claimed that the agency was not aware of information showing that GMOs were significantly different and therefore no safety testing would be required. That's what I said, guys. Companies like Monsanto, who told us that DDT, Agent Orange, and PCBs were safe, would determine if their own GMOs were safe. And as a result of the Taylor policy, companies don't even have to inform the FDA before putting a GMO onto the market. And guys, there we go. And that still holds true. Make sure you stick around. Mr. Kevin Blanch is up next. Ocelli Effect at 6 p.m. Eastern. Unlock the door with Michael Burns.